In doing the interviews and just sensing how things are going here, there's one of the Dharma understandings that feels most central and really reflects maturing on the path is that we're not trying to improve, that we're not trying to get better in some way, that this is actually a path of homecoming, that there's the language of remembering, that in some way we're reconnecting or remembering, coming home to what we really are, but in some way that's been obscured, that we've forgotten. So some words from our favorite Rumi. He writes, "We meet at this appointed time, but the texts say lovers pray constantly, once a day, once a week, five times an hour is not enough. Fish like we are need the ocean around us. Do you pay regular visits to yourself? Do you pay regular visits to yourself? Don't argue or answer rationally. Let us die and dying reply." So we'll explore a little this homecoming, this making regular visits to ourselves. First, to sense, well, what does Rumi mean when he says, let us die? My understanding is that in order to arrive here, in order to arrive at home, there's a dying to any exclusive identification as a separate self. That we can't really be here and in this wholeness, in this presence, if there's some sense of what we are being hitched to some small story. So the process of coming home is over and over a letting go of, kind of recognizing and letting go of any sort of an idea or story or clinging to a small self. Any sort of identification. So, hence the meditation instructions are, in their simple essence, is notice when there's any form of clinging. Through our thinking, through our planning, through our worrying, any form of incarnating the self through these stories, and in the recognizing, in the seeing, there's a releasing. In the seeing, there's a releasing. There's a language I like for this, which is a surrendering presence. And in the same way that Eric offered into the field some language that just to experiment with, you know, these are all just words, and words are just skillful means. They might or might not serve to, in the very real way, help you find that vividness of here, here, here. But a surrendering presence is a presence that when there's a form of some type of resistance, a surrendering presence just relaxes. Another resistance arises, another thought, another clinging, another tightening, surrendering again. So one understanding of the spiritual path is dying over and over, is letting go over and over in the big ways and in the small moment-to-moment ways. And I think a metaphor that's been helpful to me is to sense that when we're living in the story of a small self, it's like being in a cocoon, and we keep retelling the story to keep in some way on a familiar setting or ground. It's like gives us ground. So we're obsessively and incessantly telling ourselves the story again and again of who we are, what's going to happen, what we need to figure out, what's going to go wrong. So it keeps us in this cocoon. And so the cocoon, it's not well ventilated. There's not terrific scenery because, you know, if you're living in the same stories over and over again. And I often say that if anybody else was whispering in my ear the stuff I constantly tell myself, you know, I wouldn't put up with it for a moment. So we are in this cocoon, and we control our environment. I mean, the basic mechanism, and Pat described it very beautifully, is that we're constantly trying to control experience. We're constantly trying to protect this perceived self. And as long as we're trying to control, as long as we're resisting or holding on, we have that familiar sense of self. In fact, the moment you stop controlling or resisting, that familiar sense of self starts dissolving. Which on some levels we say we want, but in another way it scares us. So we keep re-finding ground. So we're in this cocoon, and yet there's something in us that intuits the possibility of living from a more whole and free and awake place. And so in a way it's sometimes described as the big squeeze, because we intuit the possibility of freedom, of living in this very, in a spontaneous way, without holding back our love, without subscribing to a story of something's wrong. Like that question of who would you be if you really didn't believe something was wrong with you? That can give you a kind of flavor of not being in the cocoon. Now, I'm not sure about this cocoon metaphor, because we're watching all these break out of the cocoon and all these little caterpillars are all mushed onto the ground. And so, great, so I free myself from a limited self and then smush, you know. Anyway, so I apologize for these imperfect metaphors. So part of what happens is we begin to start noticing our strategies to try to stay safe. And we just start noticing here. And retreat is a great place to shine a light on our strategies. Especially because the ones at home, I mean, it's so easy to just keep distracted and not sense really where we're stuck. I love this story of a man and a woman sitting in a living room, and he's saying, well, if I ever get in a vegetative state, you know, where I'm dependent on a machine, please pull the plug. At which point she walks over to the TV set and pulls it. So we have our strategies of like dulling out, and we're going to talk a little bit more about our, I call them false refuges. Our true refuge is this surrendering presence, this loving, wakeful presence. But we each have all sorts of ways to keep us in that self sense where we're more familiar. And one of the big ones, of course, is controlling the other people around us so they treat us a certain way. Some of you might remember a little girl's watching her mom clean the kitchen, and she notices that her mother has several strands of white hair sticking out in contrast on her brunette head. So she asks, Mom, how come some of your hairs are white? And her mother replies, well, every time you do something wrong and make me cry or unhappy, one of my hairs turns white. The little girl thought about this revelation for a while, and then she says, Mama, how come all of Grandma's hairs are white? So we have strategies to not be fully here, and then we invite you in practice to sit and to begin to just to notice what's happening and not control things, just be. And if you watch what happens, you might have tried this already, because I invited you to, in whatever sit or walking, to stop the doings at some point and just notice, just be. And what happens is it can be kind of mysterious and dazzling and intense, and very quickly we're off and running again. And another thought or something in us says, well, maybe I should just be with the breath a little more, just to quiet a little more. Or something else, or we get interested in some other way of planning or worrying or whatever. And the reality is that when we stop controlling, it's a way of dying. Not controlling is dying. The whole way the self-sense sustains itself is by controlling. I read this somewhere. I was hitchhiking the other day and a hearse stopped. I said, no thanks, I'm not going that far. You know? So So there's a sense of that far. That's it's the most radical thing to absolutely stop controlling. So one of the big inquiries really for all of us is that the that far, that sense of ultimately that it's all going, that every one of us is facing the loss of our bodies and the loss of dear ones, and really moment by moment and life by life, it's all just, it's loss. How in the face of that do we take refuge in this presence? How do we let go in the face of that? Because that really is the big inquiry on the path. Like every one of us intuits this fleetingness of our lives. And we steel ourselves by grabbing on and by continuing to perpetuate this cocoon. How do we let go? How do we open up? I'd like to share an ancient teaching story from India that I really like. I feel like it has in it some real powerful guidelines for how, in the face of death, do we really live our lives fully. It's called Nachiketa and the Lord of Death. Some of you might have heard this. I've shared it a few times. You can find it in one of Jack's books, Jack Kornfield's books. And it begins with Nachiketa. This is a young man from India who had lost several of his friends and began to sense the shallowness of material life and was particularly appalled when his father decided to donate a whole lot of money to the temple in exchange for some sort of a merit that he could purchase for future lives. And it often felt very fake to him. So he in some way confronted his father for his hypocrisy. And his father publicly renounced him. He said, "I give you to death." You know, completely renounced him as his son. So Nachiketa left, and he went to a remote spot in a deep forest and sat waiting for death to show himself. And for 3 days and three nights, he sat there, determined to face death in his spiritual quest. He sat through hunger, pain, exhaustion, and at last he came to the land of Yama, the king of death, also known as the keeper of accounts. There he was greeted by death's three assistants, pestilence, famine, and war, who explained that Lord Yama was away. "He's out collecting rent." "That's fine," said Nachiketa. "I'll wait." When death returned 3 days later, his assistants told him about this most unusual young man who had come to seek him. Now, humans who hear of the Lord of Death usually run the other way, but this young man had been waiting steadily for 3 days. So Lord Yama went to Nachiketa, and they greeted one another, and then the Lord of Death apologized for keeping him waiting. "Welcome to my kingdom. I see you're a man intent on his journey. Alas, I've kept you waiting. I will make up for the 3 days you waited by offering you a boon. You may choose three blessings for your journey." Okay, these are three blessings to assist you in facing death and awakening. Now, because Nachiketa had been waiting 3 days, he had really entered a very luminous state of mind, and he recognized what he most needed to go on, to be on this journey. And so the first boon he requested was forgiveness for himself and all he had touched. "Let my father look upon me with the same joy as the day I was born." Nachiketa knew that only by releasing his past, only by reconciling with all that was incomplete in his heart, could he continue his journey. And so that blessing, reunion with the life that he had been pushing away, was granted, and it left Nachiketa's heart open and clear. And Lord Yama said, "Your first boon was a wise one, Nachiketa. What will be your second? Speak." And after a moment of silent reflection, Nachiketa spoke, and he asked for a second blessing. He said, "I ask the blessing of inner fire." Inner fire. Nachiketa knew that to succeed on his spiritual journey, he would need the ardor and courage and remembrance to follow the path with his whole being. So Nachiketa asked for the strength to give himself fully, to devote himself fully to his quest. Inner fire is wholehearted energy. It's a spiritual passion, a kind of shakti, the full aliveness of being. So again, Lord Yama honored Nachiketa's wisdom and blessed him with inner strength. So free from the restrictions of old conflict from a divided heart, and filled now with that limitless energy of true devotion, of a pure and sincere devotion, Nachiketa had found much of what was necessary to pass through this initiation to wake up in the presence of death. So Lord Yama asked him to name his last boon, and after reflecting, Nachiketa looked at death and said, "I ask for that which is immortal." I'm going to read to you. With some surprise, death reminded this audacious young man that he had come to the last boon and that he could really choose anything. Lord Yama then conjured up visions of what Nachiketa might have instead, a harem of beautiful maidens to travel with him on his journey, a royal golden war chariot with the world's fastest steeds, a palace where Nachiketa would be king. Nachiketa viewed all of these and more. "Why not choose among these?" death urged again. But Nachiketa was a determined youth, not easily led astray. And so he questioned the visions. He said, "Will not all of these things that you've shown me return soon enough to your own kingdom, Lord Yama?" The Lord of Death smiled at Nachiketa's understanding and answered, "Yes, it's true. Then I ask to know that which is immortal." At this, Lord Yama said, "I will grant you your third boon." And he handed Nachiketa a simple yet extraordinary gift. He handed him a mirror. "If you wish to find the secret of immortality, Nachiketa, I cannot help you more than this. You must look directly into your own being. Then you must repeatedly ask yourself the greatest of all human questions. Who am I? Look beyond your body and thoughts, Nachiketa. In this way, you will find what you seek, that which is immortal." This part of the story closes by saying, whether it's enacted in initiation or meditation, as we do here, we too must face Lord Yama. We must ask, who is it that is born and dies? As Nachiketa gazed into the sacred mirror, he entered into the profound spiritual questioning that leads to the deathless. When everything he held was released and stripped away, a pure and timeless heart revealed itself. Nachiketa was free. So let's we'll reflect on each of the three gifts or blessings that really allow us to take true refuge in that which is timeless. And just to say that, like Nachiketa, our journey always begins with some form of disillusionment. In other words, we're in the cocoon and we all of a sudden get disillusioned because we realized, oh, this is a cocoon. This isn't all there is. And sometimes it happens in more subtle ways. There's kind of an angst or a sense that there's something more. But often that's not the case. For many of us, the moments that we most get it, the disillusionment, is when we have some brush with death in some form, meaning the death of a relationship. Or we get that diagnosis that lets us know, oh, this body really is mortal. Or somebody else that we love dies. Or that we lose a job or an opportunity or something that lets us know that we've been living in a smaller space and there's no ground in that space really. Everything we thought we were doing to keep it safe and keep it working, to make our life work, we can't control it. So the disillusionment is like this light that shines on things and says, oh, there's no way to control this deal that we're in. So what happens when we get the ground shaken is that there's two options. And one is that we then try all the harder to control things. And that's, you know, we get grim, we get bitter, we get self-pitying, we blame others, we blame ourselves, we tighten up, we bring the cocoon closer around us. The other, which is really grace, because there's no self that's, you know, doing a valiant job on this, but the other, with this grace, is that when the ground starts shaking, that something in us senses the possibility of letting go into something larger, entrusting ourselves to something larger. There's some sense that there is a refuge, there is a presence and a love and a peace that we can entrust ourselves to. So we let go some. So this is kind of the archetype of the journey, that we hit the obstacle, that there's some disillusionment. We get it that our habitual strategies aren't working, our false refuges aren't working, that in some way to awaken we need to let go, to open. So then, as Lord Yama offered Nachiketa, there are the blessings, are what we might call the gateways to refuge that really allow us to be free. And the first of these gateways to true refuge is forgiveness. And I'm hoping that this talk will be building on what Eric covered in such a wonderful way, and Pat, that this understanding that to be free, we truly have to embrace with a deep kindness the life inside and around us. And that one of the great false refuges, the ways that we try to control things, is to keep blaming ourselves for our imperfections, because we think that that's going to, that if we just get on our own case enough, we'll work it out, we'll fix it, we'll get better. I mean, that, you know, we're doing it for a good reason in our minds. So we keep on blaming ourselves, and it's very repetitive and incessant for what's wrong with me, and we do it to the world around us. If only I can change you and blame you enough, you know, then I can control you. So the big inquiry really in this first boon is, how am I creating separation? You know, where in my life am I pushing a part of myself away or another away? In the cocoon, there's these stories of wrongness. You know that that's the flag of trance, of the cocoon, that you're wrong or I'm wrong. There were a couple of letters that Dear Abby admitted she was at a loss to answer. I thought I'd read you a couple of them. So, Dear Abby, I suspect that my husband's been fooling around, and when confronted with the evidence, he denies everything and said it would never happen again. Dear Abby, I'm a 23-year-old liberated woman who's been on the pill for 2 years. It's getting expensive, and I think my boyfriend should share half the cost, but I don't know him well enough to discuss money with him. Dear Abby, I have a man I can't trust. He cheats so much, I'm not even sure the baby I'm carrying is his. So there's the habit of out there, something's wrong. And just to say a bit about forgiveness, to add on to what I think that we collectively know deep down, is that the fear in forgiving is that in some way we're giving permission for harmful behavior. If we forgive ourselves our imperfections, we're kind of given the green light. We forgive another, it's just some sort of an indulgence that's going to happen. I remember the cartoon that had two doctors beside a dying man's bed, and they're saying to him, "So, could we have all your stuff after you die?" And the subheading is, "Doctors Without Boundaries." So forgiving doesn't mean erasing boundaries. And as Eric was pointing to, we have to have a wise discrimination about what causes suffering. And it's out of compassion and wisdom that we create boundaries and we respond to harmful behaviors. And that is different than the quality of heart that says, "You're bad, I'm bad," and creates dividedness. So as Ramana Maharshi said, that we commit ourselves on this path to not pushing anybody or any part of ourselves out of our hearts. That's the commitment. And the truth is that when we are blaming in any way, when we're in that cocoon, our story of blame blocks out the truth of who's there. We can't see a person clearly if there's any story of wrongness when our heart's tight. And when we're blaming, our own self-sense contracts. And each of us knows what it feels like in any moment that we're blaming other people. There's an anonymous quote that says, who is it who's unhappy? He or she who finds fault. It's not a good feeling. It doesn't. I love the way Charlotte Joko Beck puts it. She says that our failure to know joy is directly reflected in our inability to forgive. So this first blessing is to free our hearts. And forgiving is a whole process. It's a life process. And it has to, by nature, be gradual. And often it needs support. Another person helping to hold the space. And it can't be forced. We can't will forgiveness. But we can have a willingness. And I found in my own life that if I just have the intention, if I remember for the freedom of my heart, for the healing of my heart and this world, may this heart not push others out. May I not believe my stories of blame. May I not push any part of this life out. We can have that intention, and it's amazing how that just carrying that intention opens the door. So maybe just to give you a story of one man I was working with some years ago, his wife left him, and it was the perfect setup for, you know, if you're in the cocoon and something goes wrong, that he blamed her for breaking her promise. And what happened was, because he felt so betrayed, there was that triangulating with the kids where he couldn't help himself. He just, in his anger, would say things to line them up against her. And it was awful. And then he flipped and began to blame himself. And it got even worse, that he blamed himself and said, I'm unattractive, I'm unworthy, nobody would ever want to be with me, I deserve this. And so we began to do this forgiveness practice. As he basically explored, well, what would happen if instead of telling myself that story, I just felt what was here, felt it underneath. And what he started getting in touch with underneath all his stories of I'm a failure was this enormous grief. And as long as he was running the story of I'm a failure, he couldn't feel the grief. It was not a state, a feeling in his heart he could contact if there was any story of blame. And when he started to feel the grief, that's when he could have that moment that we've described here where if it's pure connection with grief, then we begin to get compassionate. That's when he could then begin to shift his relationship with his inner life. And instead of, I'm bad, I'm a failure, he opened to that forgiving presence that was just kind. His practice was to, whenever he caught the story of an imperfection that he was blaming, was to say, forgiven, forgiven. He needed something very short, and what that meant to him, not again that this isn't a big deal, I can go ahead and be the way I want to be. It's more this heart that says, this imperfection's included. To forgive is to release the armor, to release the resistance against. So his practice was really what started blaming her was to begin to say forgiven and forgiven, forgiven to the imperfections right here. He said he discovered the who he was as a field of compassion that he could have never discovered if he had stayed in his story. Some of you might remember this ritual that this African tribe, the Ku, in Matobu, have, and I just think it's such a powerful expression of wisdom. It's called the Drowning Man Trial. If someone's murdered, after a year of mourning, the family goes to the edge of the river, and the killer's taken out in a boat and bound so he can't swim and dropped into deep water. And the family of the dead has to make a choice. They can either let him drown or they can swim out and save him. And the Ku believe that if the family lets the killer drown, if they seek revenge, they'll have justice but never heal the wound of loss. But if they save him, in other words, if they admit that life isn't always just and open to just how it is, let go into how it is, if they accept the reality of the loss, that very act can begin to heal their sorrow. The Ku put it this way. They say, vengeance is a lazy form of grief. Vengeance is a lazy form of grief. Any of our reactivity, and the word lazy, take it in whatever way you'd like, but in some way it's saying it's a substitute, it's a false refuge. It doesn't work. Our story of blame, whether it's towards ourselves or another, our ways of creating separation, make us temporarily feel powerful or safe, but there's no way to heal if we believe in wrongness. Nelson Mandela was in solitary confinement for 12 years. And as his story goes, around that time he started getting depressed, which means he's not a natural depressant. But he started getting depressed. And he, when he checked in with himself, he was depressed because he began to sense that he was going to live and die and never have the chance to love again. So he was sensing Lord Yama, sensing this life is passing and I'll never love again. And so he started asking himself, who can I love? Who can I love? And it came to him. He could love his jailer. Now, his jailer, a white jailer, had been the man that he was in solitary, had been seeing the only contact who was humiliating him, who was torturing him physically. So he decided to love this man that had been causing him a lot of pain. And so he went about that for the next 3 months. And after 3 months, they had to get rid of that jailer because he could no longer torture Mandela. Substitute, put in another one. Same thing happened. He just loved his jailer, and his jailer, they couldn't torture him anymore. And this happened several rounds. As it turns out, in his inauguration, and this was the media took this all over the world, that first jailer, that first white jailer, he invited him as an honored guest to his inauguration. And then, as many of you know, responsible for one of the most radical and profound healing processes ever seen on planet Earth, truth and reconciliation, where rather than living in the cocoon and playing out the story of blame, there's a naming, a recognizing and allowing of truth. Letting go of the story and opening to truth. So just take a moment. We'll just take a few moments to reflect on each of these gateways to true refuge. This first one, this first gateway, forgiven, forgiven, of seeing any way that we're creating dividedness, putting ourselves down, another down, and having the intention to include the life that's been pushed away. So take a moment and as you're pausing to really arrive fully right here. Listening. And with that receptivity of listening, feeling, just receiving the sensations. And you might sense if there's any way that you're at war, resisting, pushing away, putting down part of yourself. Maybe there's some current through the day or through the week where you've been at war with a part of your experience. Feeling of falling short, fear, anger, or it may be a sense of being at odds with another person, and just to feel where that, underneath that being at odds, where the vulnerability lives. Just getting in touch with what's under there. And in a very simple way, feel your intention to include this vulnerability, include this fear, this hurt. You know, just offer the word forgiven, forgiven. If it helps to put your hand on your heart, just to feel that connection. This gateway to true refuge is to sincerely let go of the ways we make war with ourselves and each other. Forgiven, forgiven. So that whatever's going on right this moment, if it's difficult, if it's numbness or sleepiness or confusion, forgiven, forgiven. Just sense the possibility of that atmosphere of a forgiving heart. Rumi writes, be ground, be crumbled so wildflowers will come up where you are. Be ground, be crumbled so wildflowers will come up where you are. You've been stony for too many years. Try something different. Surrender. Okay, opening your eyes. So we spend some time with this first gateway to true refuge because as long as we're in any way at war with ourselves or each other, we're divided, we're stuck in that cocoon of small self. The second boon, the inner fire, and I like the language of the inner fire, which is really the love and interest in life that allows us to give our being wholeheartedly to the path. Robert Frost says, something we were withholding made us weak until we found it was ourselves. So the inner fire really is that remembering of what matters, that connecting with our sincerity, where we actually are alive with knowing we want to be free, we want to know truth. It's that in us which knows we want to realize and live from the wholeness of who we are. So then we look and say, well, what would even make it possible for a group of us to come and hang out for a week in the springtime and sit still and be with what's not always so pleasant? That's the inner fire. There has to be some deep sense of trust and aliveness and some passion about waking up. George Carlin says, I'm not into working out. My philosophy is no pain, no pain. So it's different than that. There's some deep sense that it matters. And yet, what ends up happening is that we get disconnected. And in our daily life, and here, there are phases that we can sense that we're just holding back. We're not just letting go into it. And just to invite you for a moment to sense in your life, and you might reflect on this, how you hold back. You may just just in a kind of gentle scanning sense, how do you hold back from loving the ones who are close to you? Or from expressing your creativity? Or from really experiencing the fullness of your spiritual life? I mean, in a moment, in this moment, how do you hold back from full presence? What we find when we begin to investigate is that we all have a set of false refuges, ways that we take kind of substitutes that we go after that prevent us from bringing our energy in an awake and clear way to the deepest level of loving and presence. Every one of us has them to some degree. And for some of us, the false refuge I already mentioned, it's buying into the story of limitation, that in some way, well, I don't have what it takes, or, you know, I'll meditate now and then, but I'm not really the type to be liberated, to be free. We have a story about enlightenment, that it's not, we're not cut out for it, or something like that. And then we might say that we don't have what it takes to be intimate, to truly be intimate with another person, and just believe that story. So that's one of the ways that we take false refuge. We believe our stories. And then we hold back from really giving ourselves to loving, because we're believing it. We also have a lot of different ways of numbing ourselves and distracting ourselves with fantasies and food and sleep and email and so on. We fixate on the future. I think it was Suzuki Roshi who said, you can't have any real or authentic or honest full presence here if there's any sense of a future. Just any idea of a future, and we're not honestly fully right here. We fixate on the future. And then we observe our life from a distance. We kind of look through a window and analyze so that we're not so much in our body and feeling the vulnerability and aliveness. It's like reading a movie review instead of going to the movie, or thinking about nature but not smelling the scents and seeing the greens and walking barefoot in the grass. There's a line, Zen and the art of reading all the books about Zen. You know. So in a big way, we avoid taking risks and making mistakes. This is all part of the cocoon, the strategies that keep us in the cocoon, that keep us holding back. Some of you might remember, this is one of my favorites, the Japanese eat very little fat and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The French eat a lot of fat and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. Now, the Japanese drink very little red wine and they suffer fewer heart attacks than the Brits or the Yanks. The Italians drink huge amounts of red wine and they also suffer fewer heart attacks than the above. Now, the Germans drink a lot of beers and they suffer fewer heart, and it goes on and on and on. Conclusion. Eat and drink what you like. Speaking English is what kills you. So we have, every one of us, if we're honest, in a moment or in a relationship, in our work, there's ways we hold back. We get distracted. We fixate. We don't give ourselves wholly to what's here. Another word for the inner fire is devotion. And I like to bring that into our field here because although it's very much a part of all the dharmas and all the religions, it's not always spoken of. And yet, we wouldn't do a single bit of practice if that moist, juicy quality of the heart, devotion, if that love for waking up wasn't alive in us. So I like the word devotion. And the practice that really awakens the inner fire, what we do here so often is this reflection of what matters, what really matters to us. Rilke says, you see, I want a lot. Perhaps I want everything. The darkness that comes with every infinite fall and the shivering blaze of every step up. You have not grown old, and it is not too late to dive into your increasing depths where life calmly gives out its own secret. You have not grown old, and it is not too late to dive into your increasing depths where life calmly gives out its own secret. I find for myself that when I come to retreat, because I slow down and I'm not so busy, I start getting back in touch with what matters to me. And it happens every time. Doesn't mean I'm completely out of touch when I'm not at retreat. I mean, I feel like there's some continuity, but it gets much deeper and much more alive. And often the way it comes for me is grief, that I'll slow down and remember that what matters is loving. Not loving a specific person as much as being love. And I'll sense how many moments there's a kind of more of a small self busily on her way somewhere kind of sense. And then that grief will come up of the missed moments of really living it, of really living that love. Happens every time. And I feel like what it is that I'm pausing enough from my false refuges to come back home to the true refuge of loving presence, of remembering that that's what matters. There's a reflection I sometimes do that is, you know, I'll sit and sense, well, if I was going to die in 3 minutes, you know, if I had 3 minutes, what would matter? How would I pay attention? What's up in 3 minutes? And I'll just, you know, get still and I'll make it as real as I can possibly make it. And it becomes so clear that nothing else matters but realizing and inhabiting loving presence. That there is no other refuge in the face of impermanence and death than being what we are. That's Ramana Maharshi's key teaching, be what you are. What you really are. And it takes pausing. And it takes arriving to sense that that's what we are. Thich Nhat Hanh, at the end of his retreats sometimes, I remember going to one of them, oh gosh, now I think it was like 15 years ago. He'll have at the end, you'll get into pairs, and first you'll bow and say, Namaste, I see the divine that lives through your eyes and being. And then he'll have you hug each other and you'll hold each other, and he has you first do 3 breaths, and with the first breath it's I'm going to die, and the second breath you're going to die, and then the third, and we have just these precious moments together. There's a direct, totally interdependent relationship between death and love. That when we open to the truth of dying, that openness is the only space of unconditional love. As long as there's any idea of a self, there's a dividedness. So there's something about when death brushes close, you know how in Don Juan, when death touches us on the left shoulder, all our pettiness falls away. Because we get what matters. That there's a timeless presence that is what we are, that is our true refuge. That presence is what we are. And this whole path is one of letting go over and over again of this misunderstanding, of this story of a separate self, so that we can not find that, but come back home to it, because it's always here. That's why the Tibetans say it's easier than we can possibly imagine. It's this backward step into what's here. Which brings us to our third blessing. So we, in the face of this impermanent world, you know, if we have 3 minutes to live, we have some care about letting go of the resistance, not pushing ourselves away, not pushing anyone else away. So there's that forgiving. And then in that sense of the truth of this fleeting life, we say, what matters? And we sense, well, what really matters to us? If you're at the end of your life looking back, and you think of the people that you love and the activities you do, what really matters? And we get it that it's not worth fixating on the future and worrying, because you only have 3 minutes anyway, you know. But we always only have just this. And we get it that it's really sad that we would spend our moments blaming ourselves for our imperfections or making others wrong. So we put down the blame and we remember what matters. And then the third blessing is we look deeply and honestly at who's here. We look into the mirror. The human mind, writes Zen Master Dogen, has absolute freedom as its true nature. There are thousands upon thousands of students who have practiced meditation and obtained this realization. Do not doubt the possibilities because of the simplicity of the method. Do not doubt the possibilities because of the simplicity of the method. If you can't find the truth where you are, right here, where else do you expect to find it? So meditation is training and seeing the fixations, the way we get lost in the trance, and over relaxing the grip. Over and over relaxing back into that groundless, mysterious presence. This is what the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. You know, he looked into his own awareness and discovered the radiance of the awakened heart and mind. Making regular visits to ourselves. So how do we look in the mirror? I mean, what does that really mean? A lot of our practice of getting here is we train to notice what you might call the objects in our field. You know, notice the breath, that's an object. Notice the sound of the birds. Notice sensations in the body. Notice what's happening with the breeze in the tree. That's beautiful. That's part of the reality that's presenting. But looking in the mirror takes it further. It means looking into the very presence that's aware. So that even as you sit right now, if you start sensing a quietness, and you can do this. Just listen. And then just to be the quietness that's listening. Sounds happen. Relax into that space, that silence that's aware. Nothing to control. You might ask, who is listening? What's aware? It's not a mental inquiry, just to gently glance back and sense the presence that's right here. Just become that. Embody it. The presence, the silence that's listening. We look into the mirror and sense the silence, the presence as awakeness. It's the innate quality is awakeness. It's open and empty and awake. listening to and feeling what's here. And looking back into awareness and sensing the presence itself. This open, awake space. And the simple, deep practice of just having the senses wide open. When we notice the thinking, just to relax the grip. And then notice the presence itself that's here. That which is listening. Luminous, vast awareness. This is Rilke. He says, center of all centers, core of cores, almond self-enclosed and growing sweet. All this universe to the furthest stars and beyond them is your flesh, your fruit. Now you feel how nothing clings to you. Your vast shell reaches into endless space, and there the rich, thick fluids rise and flow, illuminated in your infinite peace. A billion stars go spinning through the night, blazing high above your head. But in you is the presence that will be when all the stars are dead. So just to open your eyes, and we'll close with a few words. So we're really describing tonight some kind of core elements of the path of transformation. That in the face of this living, dying world, when we let go of whatever divides us from ourselves and each other, when we remember what it is we really care about, and then when we get quiet and just look and sense who's here, the presence itself, there's a natural freedom, and then we bring that freedom into the ways we live in this earth. And we see this at the very end of the Nachiketa story, which I want to just end my talk by telling you about. We see a young man bowing to Lord Yama a final time, totally at peace. Then, as if by magic, the landscape of the kingdom of death changes to the spring rice fields of his native India. In this, a last secret is revealed to him. Death and birth are not separate. Renewal comes by dying. When we have faced death and aloneness, we are unafraid to live, and life flowers under our feet. Everywhere we go becomes holy ground. Nachiketa knew this in his heart and walked off toward his home to embrace his father and start a new life. And in the same way, every moment that we come fully home to this presence, which is what we are, we step on the earth and we celebrate this life. Our words express that loving presence, and our actions become actions that can help heal this earth. So we'll just end again, as we've been doing, just to sit quietly for a moment. in a simple way, just to let yourself feel that homecoming. Homecoming to the presence that's right here. A billion stars go spinning through the night, blazing high above your head. But in you is the presence that will be when all the stars are dead. Stay.